Okay, you're listening to CKUT Radio. I'm Joe Broadhurst, and I'm joined by Dr. Chris Busby from Green Audit in the United Kingdom. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can you tell us just a little bit about Green Audit and what you guys are doing?
Well, Green Audit is an environmental consultancy, and it's an independent consultancy that was set up in order to examine environmental data, independent of the establishment or the government, to see what truth there was in stories about ill health relating to exposures to chemicals or radiation or other exposures that there are.
And you guys had a few years back done some recorded levels from Chernobyl, is that correct? And found that there were very high levels in Europe.
We looked at infant leukemia after Chernobyl, and found that there was a significant excess of infant leukemia in a number of countries in Europe, which had also been shown by other people too. But what we did was we examined the risk factors that are currently used to underpin the operation of nuclear power and other exposures, including uranium exposures, and we showed that the present risk models are incorrect for internal radiation exposure. That's substances that are radioactive but have been inhaled or ingested or end up inside people.
And how do you actually measure these kind of levels? Do you have certain stations based in the UK or
around
Europe?
The data that we use is generally data that we get from other sources. We have got methods of measuring them ourselves. We measure concentrations on filters and in sediment and so on. But mostly what we do is we either take samples and have them measured in other laboratories, or else we use official data. In the case of the most recent example, which is the uranium, we're using data from the atomic weapons site at Aldermaston in Berkshire.
And I want to tell our listeners a little bit about this. In the Times of London and where I saw it in the Australian, you guys had reported that uranium levels were, was it fourfold?
Yes, that's right. There's a sharp increase in uranium levels over the period of the Gulf War in the filters that are deployed near the atomic weapons establishment in Aldermaston in Berkshire. These are filters that are on-site filters, where they work on atomic weapons, but also off-site, up to 15 kilometers away, to the north, to the south, to the east, to the west. And these filters are there as control sites, so that if there is an increase in some concentration of a radioactive substance, they can say whether the stuff is coming from Aldermaston or not. It was set up in the 90s following the discovery of a childhood leukemia cluster close to the site, and some people thought it was releases from the site that was causing the increases. Anyway, the filters are there, and they measure uranium, amongst other things. They measure uranium every 2 weeks.
And now you attribute these high levels, or at least in the reports, they attributed these high levels to uranium aerosols. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. We believe that this is evidence that uranium aerosols from the Gulf War traveled to Europe.
And when you say the Gulf War, you're talking about the Iraq War, is it?
Yes, the Persian Gulf. Yeah, the Iraq War.
So, and that would be attributed to the military using these kinds of using uranium in their weapons.
Yeah, the military have been using uranium anti-tank weapons since the first Gulf War in 1991, and we believe that they've been putting uranium warheads inside bunker busting bombs and cruise missiles. The evidence comes from examination of U.S. patents, mainly the number of patents for weapons that are guided missiles or bunker-busting bombs, which contain a penetrator rod of uranium in the front end to enable them to penetrate reinforced concrete or other armor. And these patents show the existence of these weapons, and lots of the film from Iraq shows the use of weapons that are similar, and there were lots of attempts to penetrate bunkers there, so we think that the increase in uranium that's been measured in Iraq is a consequence of the use of these uranium weapons.
Now, has there anybody measured these kind of levels in Iraq itself?
Yeah. Japanese have measured them in Iraq, and I've got data from, well, I've been to Iraq and measured increases in uranium in Iraq before the second Gulf War, so this is a uranium that was used in the first Gulf War. In fact, the authorities are quite, the establishment, military establishment, are quite happy to concede that they used 350 tons of uranium in the first Gulf War. They're a bit coy about how much they used in the second Gulf War, but a number of strategic analysts have suggested that it's more than 1,000 tons, more like 1,800 tons, because of the use in these big bunker busters. So, yes, yeah, so I've measured it in Iraq, and we have measurements from urine tests on British soldiers which show increased levels of uranium in their urine from the Gulf War too. And as I said, the Japanese have been measuring urine concentrations in people from Iraq, which show high levels.
Do you know what kind of lasting effects these does this kind of substance leave the body at some point? Or
we believe that the kind of uranium that's being used, the kind of uranium that's produced when these things hit the target and burn, is an entirely new kind called ceramic uranium. And these are very small particles that are generated, the oxide particles generated at temperatures in excess of 4,000 degrees centigrade. And so they form a particular kind of little glassy bead, which is smaller than the wavelength of light. And this is effectively a gas. And when it gets into the system, it's virtually insoluble. And then it lodges inside various parts of the body as a result of being translocated through the lymphatic system. And so then it just stays there for a very long time. And it can cause cancer and lymphoma, leukemia.
It can cause leukemia?
Yeah.
And the so-called Gulf War syndrome, could that...
Well, yes, we believe... Well, there's a lot of dispute about this. I mean, basically, the authorities say, oh, well, you know, it's very safe, it's very harmless, the radiation levels are so low. And on the other hand, there are a lot of independent scientists, myself included, who argue that what happens is that you can... This is a significant part of the Gulf War syndrome phenomenon. And the reason for this is that uranium from these particles can bind to DNA, and it particularly also binds to nervous system tissue. So it can cause increased levels of binding and damage to the brainstem, to that part of the brain that operates the sort of housekeeping end of living systems. And so a lot of the malfunctions that are associated with the Gulf War syndrome have to do with this kind of brainstem problem. So we think that, yes, the uranium is a significant cause of Gulf War syndrome.
And what do you guys, have you petitioned the government to stop using this kind of stuff?
Oh, indeed, yeah, sure. Many people have done that. I mean, my position is that that's mainly of a scientist, so I haven't spent much time petitioning the government. But I did give evidence on this to the U.S. Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs about 3 years ago, and I talked, and I've also given evidence to the Royal Society. And I'm on the Ministry of Defense Depleted Uranium Oversight Board, and in all of these capacities, I've pointed out the dangers associated with using this weapon. And also, more recently, of course, as a result of this discovery and a lot of the other things that I've looked at, I went to Kosovo and I found this material, you know, about a year after the conflict in Kosovo. There was material still floating about in the streets, and we measured it. We brought it home, brought samples home, and measured it and showed that it was DU. The point about it is that if it is able to float about the place and affect populations at large rather than the soldiers who are fighting the battle, then it kind of comes into a new category. It's a category of a weapon of indiscriminate effect, rather like a nerve gas, you know, or some agent that is not really allowed under the Geneva Convention. It's a human rights issue.
It's a human rights issue. Okay. And for people in Europe, I know because I've lived in France that there was lasting effects of Chernobyl.
Yes.
So when you're talking about these kind of gases floating over Europe, what kind of lasting effect could we see in the future?
It's really going to be very hard to say. I mean, first of all, I think the concentrations are very, very low. You know, so it's nothing like comparable to Chernobyl. My main point about writing this paper and doing this research is to show that the material is capable of traveling long distances. The military say it isn't, and this is evidence that it is. In fact, probably the first evidence that it is capable of traveling such long distances. Now, although it might have very small risk of causing cancer or causing heritable genetic damage, you know, infant mortality, stillbirths, those sorts of things. The fact that it can travel such large distances means that it can contaminate very large populations. We're talking about millions and millions and millions of people who've inhaled these particles. We can show from calculations that the number of particles inhaled by somebody near the atomic weapons site where the filter measurements were made is 23 million particles per person. So that's a lot of uranium particles. And I would think that there might be an effect from this, but it's hard to know what it would be. And certainly the first place I'd look would be in infant mortality data. So I'm currently waiting to obtain the monthly infant mortality data from the UK to see if there was any change in infant mortality or stillbirths or any birth effects 9 months after this event. That would be, you know, towards the end of 2003, beginning of 2004.
Okay, well, I thank you for joining me this morning, and I'm going to follow up with you a little bit later on this. I've been speaking with Dr. Chris Busby. He is the Director of Science at Green Audit, and you can find them at greenaudit.org. I thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Okay, cheers.